All right. So let's get into this. Let me introduce myself. My name is Vasily. I've been in the industry of software development close to 20 years now as a sort of a professional endeavor, and before that as a hobby for many, many years more. No matter how laughable or ridiculous these attempts have been, you got to start somewhere. And Mo, how about you?
Well, I've been in the industry for a few years or so myself. I have a master's degree in software engineering, and I currently work as a software developer, front end, back end, and other things. It's really nice to talk to you, Vasily, and to learn from you in different ways. And I really appreciate your time.
Sure. I guess as a bit of a background, has it been a couple of years now, I believe? Close to 2 years?
Yeah,
Yeah. So
it's been almost 2 years
yeah,
now.
Mo,
About 2 years,
about 2 years,
actually.
yeah. Mo reached out to me through a mutual friend, and she called me and said, "Hey, I have this guy, he's a developer and he kind of needs a little bit of mentorship. Do you would like to take him on?" And I said, "Yeah, sure," because I kind of did a bunch of mentorship through the company I was working for at the time, and it's kind of this paying it forward mentality. You share the lessons you've learned throughout your career and how you approach different situations, and yeah, it's been going on pretty much since then. We have weekly chats, and Mo asks various questions about the industry, about all sorts of things, really. I guess we started more around the industry and like technology, but with time it expanded a little bit into more broader topics. So there it is. That's kind of like the situation here, and now we will get to the actual questions that Mo has prepared for us for today.
Actually, today I'm looking to ask you a lot of questions,
All right.
so be prepared. One of the things I wanted to ask you is because recently in our team we have some changes going on, and I can see like different things that used to be a certain way no longer looks like that. For example, I see like some of the teams are moving out of like using the traditional development processes. For example, in our team now, we're trying to move away from QAs. So I'm wondering, like, what are some of the biggest changes that you've seen in software development so far in your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess in general, in software engineering, things are very hectic. Everything kind of tends to change. There are these cycles that are very short compared to other industries. Some industries are perfectly happy to be doing what they're doing like 5 years, 10 years at a time, with some incremental improvements in the process, of course. But in software, there's a lot of changes. There's new frameworks coming out, new software tools coming out, new methodologies, new approaches. A lot of it feels like it's kind of a hype driven. People go to the front page of Hacker News and it's like, oh, there's this brand new shiny thing, so let's try it out, and everybody kind of gets on it. There's a lot of people saying, yeah, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And then a few months later, like, it is kind of nice, but there's like all these things that we don't like. And then something new and shiny shows up and the cycle kind of continues. So that's sort of like this short cycle of like hype and disappointment, so to speak. And for a lot of places, I guess some of these things sort of stick around. But in a bigger trend that I definitely observed in like last 15 years, is this desire for people to go toward like a multi-instrumentalist type role. Whereas before I was remember working at a company, it was like a financial services management company, and they had dedicated database administrators, they had dedicated network people, they had server people, they had people responsible for deployment, they had QA, they had testers, they had developers, managers, everything was sort of like very, very clear cut, and people would communicate by sort of passing things back and forth. And You know, back in those days, I guess financial industry especially, they could definitely afford having everybody occupying a very specific kind of niche role. So it's very chill. You know, you do your tasks, and if there's no tasks, then you just chill out because, well, hey, you know, what are you gonna do? Mm-hmm. And I guess with the economic pressures and everything else, there has definitely been this shift of, like, each person needs to do more. They need to cover more ground. They need to cover more. It's like, well, we can't just have front-end developers. We have to have full-stack developers. We want for people to be able to run front-end, back-end at the same time. They should be good with SQL. They should be good with database queries, but they should also be good for, like, document databases. They should be good with infrastructure as code. They should be good with DevOps. Like, they have to be good with literally everything. Which is, it makes it more challenging, I think, to enter because you're expected to know so much, like right out the door. It's like, oh, hey. Before, if you say, yeah, you know, I wrote a little bit of Java, a little bit of C++ in college, and it's like, okay, well, join our team, we'll train you on things, you know, write some server code, do things like that. Now, it's like searching for a unicorn. A person like straight out of college must know so much. And again, on top of the hype cycle, the new things are coming out super fast and people want those shiny new things. So, and the other thing that I noticed is like when I was in school, we will like 20 years ago, when I was in school, we were learning things that were like by then like 10 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And with the hype cycle of 6 months, 10 years is a long time. And I think that higher education isn't necessarily quick enough or agile enough to keep the pace with this because like developing a curriculum is a really, really difficult job. It's like quite a massive endeavor. And so they can't afford to redo their curriculum every time some fancy schmancy framework comes out. And, you know, that kind of shows people really have to be willing to learn on their own and just try out different things. So if to summarize, yeah, everybody's switching to be more of a like a polyglot, know a lot about a lot. Specialization is still going to occur just because people sort of naturally favor some things more than others. Like I have written all kinds of software on a server, even back in the day, a little bit of like desktop applications, like classic Windows desktop applications. I've done front end. I've done a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but right now I'm mostly gravitating toward like the front end development, TypeScript, you know, React. I can do all of the other things. It's just I don't enjoy them as much, so I do tend to specialize. But at the same time, I have enough expertise to sort of pick up things if necessary.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. But I wanted to. You mentioned that expectations mm-hmm. about you expected to learn many things and just be able to wear more than one hat in the team mm-hmm. nowadays. Do you think the reason for this expectation is because probably there are more materials or like more opportunities to learn faster these days as compared to before now? Or do you think like this is just business needs?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think definitely there's definitely democratization of education in terms of like learning languages. Back in a day before sort of the era of mainstream open source, it was absolutely normal to require a subscription. For instance, like if you want to develop for Microsoft Windows, you basically need to have an MSDN subscription, which costs a lot of money. So it was out of reach of individuals. Usually students at universities had a subscription through their university and they had access to like all of the different tools. But like going to university is already a certain filter. Like not everybody is willing to or can afford it. So a lot of that stuff was not really available to people. And, you know, if you wanted to have a compiler, or if you wanted to have some sort of development environment, information wasn't readily available on the internet as well. These days, most new languages come out, if not as open source, but at least you can download the compiler, you can download the tooling, you don't have to pay. There's a few things that people still pay, or like you may have to license it for commercial use, but to learn and play around with it, usually you can just download it, install it, and play around with it. So the experimentation and exploration is all on you. There's also a lot of materials, courses, free courses, paid courses. YouTube is a massive source. There's a ton of content creators on YouTube who talk about various languages, beginners, how to, you know, get acquainted with different languages. So these days it's completely, completely different. I mean, for me personally, was when I was a kid and I was starting out, back in Russia, getting licensed Microsoft products was basically impossible. However, getting unlicensed Microsoft products was easy. And so, you know, I started my career, so to speak, with like pirated versions of Borland, Delphi, and things like that. And I think a lot of the people had the similar start back then in those countries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were ways around it. But there's definitely more information now, more access to tooling, and you know, you don't need much to start. In fact, these days it's kind of paradoxical, but if you have your browser just by itself, you can start learning programming right there. You know, you press F12, the console pops up, you can input JavaScript code and it'll run and it will do things. So every computer now comes with a browser. And it comes with like a good recent browser that supports all of these different technologies. So it is really one keystroke away for some people, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I agree. That's true. Like, and also like these days, there's a lot of, like you said, like aside from like the tools are more readily available, I also find like a lot of people actually also have access to resources, like learning resources. And also like boot camps, different, all these things keep popping up. So like there's more opportunity to learn, there's more opportunity to improve. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why the expectations is actually becoming much more. But as much as the expectation is getting higher, do you think it's like feasible to be able to be a master of all these hats? So for example, like, you're expected to do front end, you're expected to do back end. Sometimes you might do some other things that is not in one of these ends, but you know, but do you think it's something that can be done effectively in to be able to wear all this art?
I think I'll try answering that in a little bit of roundabout way, because let me preface. I think now, going back to the question of what's different, there's definitely way more glamour associated with IT, right? Like, if I remember my days at college learning information systems, as the program was called, it was essentially like 98% nerds, the people who are very interested with it just for the sake of just computing and all the things related to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you just sit in front of your computer all day, you know, like you barely do anything else for most part, right? And so it attracted a certain kind of character, and people were very similar who went into this field, I feel, because it wasn't glamorous. It was kind of like solitary endeavor. But now, you know, we have massively successful companies making trillions of dollars, stories of overnight success of, you know, hey, this kid at his university developed this page to share people's faces, and now he's a multi-billionaire, and you know, it could be you, maybe, right? People definitely think about that.
Of course.
They make TV series about it. They make movies about it, dramas and documentaries and everything. So, and a lot of people realize that this is the industry that pays really well. And so I feel like before, for a lot of people, the motivation wasn't necessarily, it's like, oh, you know, if I go into this industry, I can get paid really, really well. It was more, I really enjoy technology. I really enjoy programming. And this is the area where I can have all of that and they will pay me a salary. So that's like just amazing. Best of both worlds. But now I definitely have seen an influx of people, and I have nothing against that because, you know, people have to follow their interests. And if they desire, you know, being well compensated for their job, that's absolutely excellent. They should definitely do that. But I guess the incentive for people to go into the industry, they think it's like, oh, if I know coding, I can be a developer at some hot startup and have my stock options. And if it makes it big, I'll be a millionaire, right? Or maybe, hey, it looks like a fairly straightforward job. You just sit in front of a computer 9 to 5 and you get paid a pretty penny, right? So who wouldn't want that? So there's definitely been like a blend between people who go to it for like computing sake and people who go to it for like money or other reasons. Mm-hmm. And I heard it before from other people, is that people who are genuinely interested in the computing part of it and the technology part of it, because that's fun for them, they're going to spend, you know, way more time studying because they enjoy it compared to somebody who's like, oh, 5 p.m., you know, I gotta go back home and, you know, do my other hobbies. And so I think for some people, it's definitely possible to just sit in front of your computer 12, 14 hours at a time and ingest as much information as possible and get really good at a whole bunch of different things. And then there's people who are going to be solid developers who sort of pick their niche and stick to it and achieve a certain level of success in there. And again, there's nothing really wrong with that. It's basically, if you're motivated by the love of the art, you're going to have maybe different outcomes compared to if you're motivated by just the financial part of it. So my answer is yes, it's possible, but I feel like you really have to be interested in doing it because it's not easy. As like things change very quickly. A lot of knowledge kind of becomes obsolete. There's a lot of hype. And especially if you're just starting, it might be difficult to filter out all of the BS and focus on fundamentals. One unfortunate side effect of that, like you mentioned boot camps, and boot camps are great. I mean, I taught at a boot camp for multiple years, and I helped people essentially from zero to, you know, being a solid junior developer who knows how to learn and who can build things from scratch by himself, right? But they tend to pack a lot of information in a very small amount of time. And they tend to gloss over the fundamentals. And so it becomes a little bit more mechanical. Like, you know what actions you need to perform, but you don't necessarily know fully why. Because in order to know that, you kind of have to go very deep into it. And some people don't have time for that or patience for that. And I feel like that may be an impediment in their progress later on. Just personally, I would come from school when we were doing a bunch of computer-related things all day, get on my computer and do a bunch of computer related things as a hobby till like late. It's just something I did. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I answered your question exactly, but that was sort of my thoughts on a subject.
Honestly, I appreciate your answer because it also gave me more like, I mean, we've talked about this like a few times before, and then I feel like it helps me to think about some things differently. Say, for example, I have seen scenarios where some people say on social media, they go and then they say like, oh, you need to get out of like, learn how to write code so you can make a certain amount of money. And then it feels like learning to write code or learning to work as a developer or in software engineering, generally, it's like a poverty alleviation thing. Like, it's like, if you do it, you make so much money. And for me, so far, I can tell categorically, like, if you don't have the passion for this thing, the quicker you try to get into it is how quick you will be getting out of it, because it requires so much effort, and learning is you just need to be interested.
Right,
in it.
Right. I think it also highlights this thing that I came to realize fairly late in my life. I wish I realized it sooner, but you know, professionals tend to make stuff look effortless when you observe them from the side. So you like, one of the themes is like, well, you're just on your computer all day. How hard could that be? In fact, exactly. It can be very, very hard and very frustrating. And you spend a lot of times pulling your hair out, trying to sort something out, or you get in the weeds and come up with something absolutely horrendous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then when you do a code review, you end up feeling very embarrassed about the thing you produce, because it's just mountains of trash that's kind of does what it's supposed to do. And everyone's like, there's a better way of doing that. Yeah. Right. And so, and it does create this sort of unhealthy expectation of, yeah, I just go in IT and be a millionaire. Some people do end up there, but it's kind of a lot of it, I feel, is a kind of a lottery in a sense. I mean, I would not necessarily... Yeah, I'm not sure what I was going with this, so we'll scratch that part. But yeah, I think there's a lot of luck in a way that enters into it as well. And yeah, you have to spend a lot of effort in learning things. Like one of the outcomes of boot camps is that people can build basic applications and they get a lot of encouragement from that. And then they might arrive at some problem that is a little bit more difficult, and they get stumped and they get really frustrated because they like acquired this, you know, bundle of knowledge in a very short time. And so, you know, there's a lot of analysis that goes into why things work and why things don't work. And it's also a skill that you have to acquire throughout, you know, your career, is like reasoning about what is happening and why certain things may be the way they are. Like, oh, I'm getting some specific errors. And sometimes I look at it and I don't necessarily can verbalize how the answer enters my head, but it's like, oh, it could be related to this thing. And then, you know, you go and check it out and it is that thing. And you're like, okay. But for a person who hasn't been doing it for such a long time, they can be completely stumped. And then they go to Google and search for the problem, and they get a bunch of unrelated things, and they start trying them one by one, and none of them work. Or maybe something works, but they don't understand necessarily why it works, and it's like really frustrating. And I think people are just not prepared for that side of the IT. Like, everybody is prepared for the glamorous side of IT, but not many people are prepared of, oh, hey, it's 4:30 a.m. and the server in the data center stopped responding, so you have to get there, fix it while 10 people are on the phone screaming in your ear. You know, it's like, well, what you gonna do? So there's definitely downsides that are not being so glamorous.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of downside, even, like, I think another thing is the deadlines. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like, you know, there are certain times where you have, like, maybe the client is waiting for the product to be delivered, and then you are responsible for a particular part of the feature that you are going to be delivering, and then somehow something is, something is not going right, or maybe you need some other team's input or something, different things, all those like pressures. I feel like sometimes if you're explaining all these things, how it happens to people outside of this industry, or like people who are actually looking to get into it, they don't really get the full picture unless you're into it, like the amount of pressure that can be involved in this, mm-hmm. and then how much you really need to want to be here if if you don't have this the desire to actually get through it, like it could be really overwhelming.
Yeah, but, man, it sounds like we're just basically telling people not to do it under any circumstances, but that's not the idea, right? The idea is
not the idea. It's just
like there are some unglamorous things that you have to be prepared for. And I think you touched on an interesting subject, because in a lot of industries like construction and manufacturing and things mm-hmm. like that, the process of analysis of how long things will take, I mean, it's fairly well understood. Even, well, I don't know. Again, this is not my area, so maybe I look at it as an outsider and be like, oh, you know, these guys. But then I start thinking about all the massive projects that like go way over budget and like way over time. So they probably mm-hmm. suffer from the same thing too. But that probably goes, I guess it's similar. Like if you're building a power plant or a dam mm-hmm. or a nuclear reactor, mm-hmm. it is definitely, there's a lot of unknowns. But I guess that their unknowns are in like different domains. They probably like, oh, you know, we need land rights or we need some legal thing. And like, it's a different domain where they operate.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that like in software development, there's a lot of unknowns, or not even necessarily unknowns, but because software systems have to touch other software systems, and usually everything barely works and is poorly documented for most part, and mm-hmm. the documentation is a lot of times wrong and in fact completely contraindicated. So you're trying to interface with something else and you make assumptions, and your assumptions tend to be incorrect, but you only discover it later on. And that's why like planning and estimating is really hard. And so a lot of projects kind of end up being over time and over budget. In my career, I've seen maybe like one or maybe two projects that followed the timeline that was established ahead of time pretty closely and delivered roughly when they say they would without sacrificing a lot of functionality. And the first time I saw it, I was like, wow, this is really impressive, because it was back at the financial services industry mm-hmm. company, and we had a project manager, this great guy, mm-hmm. would love to work with him again, but he's like VP somewhere at Amazon, I believe now. So, you know, he's flying good pretty job. High. Yeah, good job. So and we were following waterfall model. I mean, it's kind of a hot take, but financial industry likes their waterfall model, or at least back when I was working there, they used to. And so he had this Gantt chart with like all of the different phases and all of the dependencies and how they all play in together. And we managed to follow that timeline pretty much verbatim. And by the end, it was done. And it was like, good job, guys. We delivered exactly on time. And at that time, I was just, my mind was blown, because like, how these things at least take twice as long. But so that was example. And the fact that was so surprising, it kind of tells you something. It's like these parts of this job are also hard.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't do them well. In fact, it's paradoxical how badly we do on estimating things. And I think people tend to overanalyze. And I think they've done research and basically said that like your first kind of gut feeling, first thing off your tongue figure is probably way closer to reality compared to if you start sitting down and analyzing all of the different things.
Yeah, true.
And yeah, people tend to underestimate because they want to look better in front of their peers. It's like, hey, we can do it in 3 days. Oh, we can do it in two. But in fact, it's going to take 2 weeks. But nobody really wants to talk about that.
That's true.
And then, yeah, the unknowns crop up on you. And yeah, It's fun, but in a tragic kind of way.
I agree. But you know, some of these things are also like different people should take responsibility for it when these things happen. But in my own experience, like I've not had as much as you have, but I'm wondering like how do you manage these kind of things? Let's say you are involved in like delivering a certain feature and the timeline is really small. Like let's say like you need to deliver at the end of the week. Hypothetically, mm-hmm. I don't think this will ever happen, but mm-hmm. let's say you get the feature today and you have to deliver at the end of the week and it's really small. How do you manage this timeline with like delivering good quality code, delivering good quality tests and all these other processes that you have to do for your feature? How do you manage this pressure in your experience?
I think everybody probably knows the triangle between like good, fast, and cheap, and you have to pick somewhere within it. So you can't have all three, right? You have to sacrifice something.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think that there are sort of two competing things. It's like on one hand, you want quality product that, you know, mm-hmm. has the features and it's solid and robust. Everybody wants that. At the same time, there is time pressures on deliverables. And one interesting thing that I've seen in my career is that those timelines and deadlines could be true or could not necessarily be true. Sometimes there can be quite arbitrary. And it's like, we just want it by the end of the week. Why? Well, we have our reasons. And those reasons and those incentives are not like communicated across the divide because the business side has certain incentives that they are operating under, and you know, development team has a different set of incentives that are usually completely orthogonal to the business side. Like they have nothing to do with one another. And effectively, if you plan for it, and you have to have a project manager that is really willing to bat for the developers in this case, I feel. I mean, I have a bias because I'm a developer and I want a good project manager on my side and in this type of scenario. And they have to be very firm on saying no to the business and being very explicit about, like, if you want it sooner with higher quality, we'd have to cut features. Or if you want it with all the features, we'll have to cut quality. And usually cutting quality most of the time wins and creates the technical debt for the future. And the other thing that is I noticed throughout a lot of companies is that business is never willing to spend money on refactoring and cleanups because from their perspective, things look exactly the same. So what's the point of spending all this money on a thing that looks exactly the same? And to some extent, they are right, because the point of software at the end of the day is, okay, for a developer, you like to write beautiful, elegant, bug-free code that is very robust, that is like self-explanatory, well-documented, mm-hmm. all of those things. For the business side, the purpose of the software is to make the company money. So if it's literally a tire fire on top of a dumpster, but it makes the money, should they care?
No. Maybe,
right?
Yeah.
And it's like, we as developers, we want certain ergonomics. Like we prefer working on a cleaner code base just because it makes it easier to reason about it and refactor and add features in. So I think eventually there's like this accumulation of crap on one side and like business resistance on the other side meets at a point where either it starts failing too much and people notice and it starts losing them money, or people working on it get so frustrated that they don't want to maintain it anymore and they leave. And like it kind of qualitatively transforms into something where like nobody really wants to touch it anymore. And then they actually have a direct incentive to change that. But usually by then, it's like so far gone that it's kind of not happening for most part. It's easier just to, you know, and here comes another fallacy. It's easier just to throw it away and rewrite it. And I mean, it's not a fallacy. In some cases, it is easier to throw it away and rewrite it. It's just people underestimate how long it's going to take to do. Recently, I've read or listened to a couple of interesting articles. One of them was basically saying all code is technical debt because all of it is going to be thrown away at some point. So everything you write will be deleted off everyone's hard drive, given enough time. So like, think of it as you would. And I was actually chatting to someone a couple of days ago about it. And I said, like, you can be fatalistic about it, or you can be sort of like, you know, well, the universe is going to explode a billion years from now anyway, so who cares? Or like, the software I write is going to be thrown away 10 years from now, so who cares? We can pile up as much garbage as we want on it. But, you know, if you're still stuck maintaining it for those 10 years, you want it to be pleasant. So there is some balance to be had between actually delivering and having some measure of comfort while doing it. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing was, I lost my train of thought. I kind of forgot what I was going to say. Like people, if they understand the effort required and they commit to it, mm-hmm. it's possible. Like the other thing that I heard, which was this fairly hot take video from a developer called Casey Muratori. He's like a game developer. He has a YouTube channel. And he was talking about how people say, oh, nobody does rewrites. That's crazy talk. Like, and he was saying, no, actually, a lot of people do rewrites. And he, as an example, he was basically saying how Facebook rebuilt their mobile app from the ground up, from like a hybrid web app into a native app, without any loss of fidelity to the original. So the new app basically looked exactly like the old app. It was just massively more performant. So they undertook the effort. It took them several years to do so. So people do rewrites. And if they understand what they want out of it, it is possible. So, yeah. I don't remember where we started, but somehow that's no, where actually, we've ended up.
Yeah, I mean, where we started was how like the pressure affects the quality of code and that you deliver based on like the amount of time that you mm-hmm. end up having. But speaking of Facebook doing rewrites, like Facebook can afford to do rewrites because it's Facebook, right?
Well, like, Facebook can afford to do rewrites, but recently, you know, a bunch of companies that can afford stuff did let go a whole bunch of people because they still have business incentives and like your incentives have to align. And if that point where the tire fire on top of a dumpster and the desire for it to be completely rewritten aligns with, hey, that tire fire doesn't deliver our customers anymore. In fact, everybody's mm-hmm. bitching and complaining because the damn thing never works and constantly crashes and like eats your homework. And we have the resources to do it. And the like internal company political will to do it, like there has to be like this perfect alignment of these factors, and then it could happen, or sometimes it doesn't happen, and mm-hmm. you know, that's life.
Fair enough. Has there ever been a time where like you were responsible for a particular feature not being delivered on time?
I probably would say yes. I don't know if I remember specifics, but it's just the nature of things. The things that stand out more in my mind was when we had the situation where, you know, we were selling a product. It was kind of a software as a service type product. And we had a sales team that was calling people and offering them our wonderful product, which was pretty good. And a lot of times, see, here's another thing. Again, it's like the battle of different incentives and how they align. A sales team, you know, they work on commission. They're interested in making a sale. Mm-hmm. Like, that's their primary goal, is to make a sale and, you know, get paid. They could believe in the product. They would think that, you know, for the customer they're trying to sell it to, it actually solved their problems. So I'm not saying they're like completely cynical and they don't give a care, they don't give a crap about it at all. That's not the point. But in order to expedite the sale and make it happen, a lot of times they tend to make various promises to the client where they have really no business to make without consulting with people. And so I was in a situation where a salesperson, in order to close a contract for like 100 seats for our software or something like that, they promised a feature to a customer. And it was basically, everything was hinged on that one feature. Like, if we deliver that feature, then the contract is signed and everything goes through. And, you know, at the time, 100 seats was a big deal. We really wanted it. And so the crunch time was on. Everybody was pulling all-nighters and like building and doing all that stuff. We finally delivered it. The client bought they signed on a dotted line and everything was peachy. And then like a couple of weeks later, we was asking them, it's like, oh, well, how are they enjoying this new feature that we've built? And the client was like, oh, we actually don't really use it. And I was like, what? From my point of view, the world was on fire because that feature wasn't present. And now you're telling me that you don't really care. And these things happen too, right? It was really frustrating mm-hmm. because of like, holy mm-hmm. crap. Like I put my life on hold for like 2 weeks to deliver this. And there's like just zero appreciation from the target audience. And those things happen. And again, like, especially if you're working in that kind of business, you have to be prepared for that because it is frustrating. And you kind of have to have a little bit of an attitude of, I still got paid at the end of the day. So if they use mm-hmm. it or they don't use it, that's like one of the consequences mm-hmm. for me for working in consulting. It's like, I can come in and I can recommend people things and they can listen to my recommendations and they can adopt them or they can ignore them. And I don't really care because I get paid hourly. If they adopt them, great. If they don't, great. My job was to suggest, and whatever they do with it, it's their business. Because I found that if I were to take these types of rejections personally, I might end up having a very miserable time. So you kind of have to have a slight pinch of nihilism thrown into the mix to like let these things go.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. But just to change a little bit, to talk about a different side. Now, I'm wondering, like, these days we have like new, you know, in earlier you mentioned like shiny products coming out every time. So I'm wondering, like, for you right now, do you have a shiny product that's currently out right now that you are, you know, interested in, that catches your interest?
I guess, yeah, there is. But I also know myself. I know that in the previous years, I would see something shiny and I would be like, ooh, I have to have it and play with it. And I would acquire it, poke mm-hmm. around with it for a few days and be like, meh, and, you know, go on with my life. So I'm trying to sort of temper my expectations. I have a closet full of various embedded development boards and like various gizmos that I thought I'd do something cool with. And maybe it's just, it can be attributed just to my lack of discipline, but I tend not to. I do enough. The other thing I want to mention that changed between like college me and right now me is that I do less programming outside of work now. Because, you know, mm-hmm. I also want to do other things.
Yeah.
And I think that in some ways, it kind of indicates like a certain degree of like plateauing professionally. And I don't know what to make of it. I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the way it is. Like, maybe I'd like to learn Zig, for instance, because it looks pretty interesting and cool. But I also need to do all these other things and like work on all these other projects. And so it kind of not as high on my priority list. Although I imagine learning it would probably make me better at my job. But now it's kind of a balancing act. And so if you're college age or you just graduated high school or whatever, and you have that energy and you have very few responsibilities to the rest of the world and you can dedicate a lot of time to learning all sorts of things, I think it's worthwhile. It will definitely, like, the bigger foundation you build in those years, the easier it will be to branch out and to do different things. Because I don't know if I am prepared to, you know, spend 14-hour days on my computer learning new things right now. I still do. You can't help not to in this kind of job. You have to be. Yeah, you still have to be on the razor's edge for a lot of these things. I guess the difference now is, back then I did it because I wanted to, and now I do it because I have to. And so, you know, I think it colors it a little bit differently, mm-hmm. if you think about it.
Yeah, I understand. Like, I get it, but, you know. So, for example, now, like, the other day, I was having conversation with, like, mm-hmm. you know how, like, sometimes when a few developers come together and we have, like, conversations, and it's always, like, tools, technologies, everybody's trying to, like, you know,
and then our spouses sit next to us and roll their eyes because they're like, what the hell are these guys talking about? Like, I don't understand a word. Yeah.
Exactly. And so everybody will just like bring out different things in their bag, in their front bags. But sometimes I wonder, like, you know, like, is this a thing that happens like every stage of your life? Like, does it get to a point where like you're no longer as interested as you used to be as you grow, or like this type of feeling about new things will always be there? So, for example, like a good example. Right now, if someone mentions something to me about like, oh, this programming or this tool or this, I might not use it, but I would want to know about it, mm-hmm. you know, like I would want to know what it does, or like, oh, there's this tool, or like there is this, especially in these new times of AI, mm-hmm. you want to know, keep up with the latest trends. But these things, is it really a feeling that you would have throughout your career, or do you always have to chase the latest new thing based on like how fast things change in this industry? Do you have to always be like this, or like there will come a time where you just like settle? And
well, I would say ultimately you don't have to be anything you don't want to be, right? Okay, caveat is we still have, responsibilities in our life. So for some of the things, you have to be a certain thing to fulfill them. It's no going away from that. And, mm-hmm. you know, you have to be responsible and disciplined. But I think that if you cultivate a certain degree of curiosity about these things, it will definitely help. I remember working with a fellow, and it was some years back, and Vancouver scene was pretty hot for meetups, for like technology meetups. There was like 10 different meetups, one for every language. And there was like a lot of things happening. It was kind of like booming. So there's all these different meetups. And I remember talking to my coworkers after the day's end, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to this meetup. They're going to be, I don't even remember what it was. Something a little bit more esoteric, like Erlang or Haskell or something like that. And I was talking to my coworkers, and I think I was probably, younger than them by about 10 years at the time. And I was saying like, oh, hey, there's this cool meetup and it's free. And they're going to talk about like, there's all these smart people, because I've been there before. Like a lot of people there are like quite smart. So it's really interesting to talk to them. And one guy was like, why would I want to do that? I've been doing what I'm doing for the last 5 years and I don't intend to learn anything new because I'm already so good at doing this. And to me, that was a little paradoxical, because it's like, well, if that doesn't say plateauing hard, I don't know what does, right? Because like, how can you be this unwilling to learn new things for free from really smart people? Like that to me was kind of weird, because if I have an opportunity to do that, I'd probably pick it up. So yeah, I think that, and I think like with this type of stagnation comes complacency, and disdain for new things, and you become an old fart, and nobody really wants to become an old fart.
Yeah. So technically, you're suggesting like you need to always push yourself to learn.
You have to kind of stay, you know, young and at heart and curious about things. Yeah. I think like in some areas, like for instance, when it comes to modern music, to me, a lot of it is not particularly interesting. So in that domain, I'm definitely becoming an old fart. It's like, kids these days and their whatever genre they're listening to. And
new something.
I think the problem right now with music, completely on a tangent, is that there basically is like three genres that are left. There's pretty much, like, there isn't really rock and roll anymore, except all of the bands that used to be there 10 years ago. Like, what's a new rock and roll band that is popular? Like, doesn't exist. So there's definitely country still doing strong, although it's not necessarily my type of music. Everything else is just electronic dance music. Like, I guess if you listen to like metal and stuff like that, which I did quite a bit back in the day and still do occasionally, there's like still stuff happening there. But like 2000s, so many different genres, like crazy. And it's like, oh, we have a radio station for just grunge because, you know, screw you, we like grunge. Now it's same 10 people out of every speaker, same songs written by the same formula. So it's like, it's completely kind of, it reached the end point, it feels like. Mm-hmm. There's like nothing new and interesting. Although, I don't know, maybe I'm just not listening to enough obscure stuff to kind of know.
Well, I can introduce you to some Afrobeat.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be new.
That'd be definitely new. But yeah, like musically, I'm kind of an old fart. And considering like half of my family is in music business, you know, and they are sort of in the same place, it's an okay position to be in.
Fair enough. But so finally, I'm wondering, like, if you have to start your, let's say, you know, how the, I don't know what movie that is, where you get a choice to start from the beginning, or like you take, you get, I forgot that, blue pill, red pill, you get the analogy.
Mm.
But the thing is,
reset yourself.
Yeah. Technically like that. If you have to start from the beginning right now from your career, what's something that you would wish you had known before actually like getting it?
That is a really interesting question, because, you know, a lot of times you kind of have these what if moments. It's like, what would have happened if I did this versus that? And like, I think that the answer is you don't know. It could have gone any other way. And I wouldn't necessarily say that my foray into IT has been deliberate. It was like, I kind of was introduced to computers when I was like probably 5 years old. And everything I was doing since then kind of revolved around it in some way or another. You know, when I was a kid still in school, my dad brought home like a Sinclair Spectrum clone. And I used it 99% for games, but it had like basic language built into it. So you naturally would try to input some code and see what happens. And, you know, I did. And then later on, it was like IBM PCs, Microsoft DOS, Windows. And, you know, so it's been building slowly and slowly since a very, very young age. And, you know, as I mentioned, like a lot of my family, they're in music business. So for a time, I was studying like sound engineering and acoustics and like mixing, production and mastering and things like that. So there was a point in time where my career could have gone that way instead. But I think in part, I was also interested in it because, again, it was becoming heavily computerized. Like back in the day, you go into a recording studio and it's like wall-to-wall equipment, cords and panels, and you like plug things in and out. Like if you want some effect, you route it through some patch panel with these cables. And then, you know, a couple of years pass and we go to the same guy. He was like a mastering engineer. And we go to his studio and he literally has like a Mac and a small rack full of like VST hardware plugins, and everything else is pretty much gone. So everything just kind of like just got zipped into a computer. And I think that was also partially, it's like, it's still computers in a sense, like it has to do with music, but it's still computers. So I don't even know if there was a time where I would have like an inflection point where it would be like, oh, if I do things differently here, it will be completely different in terms of just a career choice. I think what I would like to have or have had back in that, in those days, is just to have maybe more discipline and not screw around as much and like waste time on stuff. And maybe trying to build something of my own. I think one side of me that I never really developed was like this entrepreneurial side. Like I probably would be really crap at like starting a startup because it's just a completely different domain, right? Or coming up with business ideas that are viable. Maybe investing some effort into that side because like there's nothing wrong in working for a bigger company or a company in general, like working for a salary and, you know, do your thing. I think it has limited growth opportunities in a sense. And a lot of the growth happens laterally. Like you switch companies and you get better roles, but even then it tends to peak pretty quickly. Which is kind of interesting. Other thing that I just came to my mind is that there's definitely this sort of title inflation. People come into the industry and they work for a year and a half and they're senior now, you know? And so I don't know. I don't know if to me that's just like sort of, I'm just being jealous of the fact it's like, hey, I've been doing it for 20 years and I finally sort of like maybe 5 years back, I started considering myself senior. And then there's people who just barely went through the door and they're like senior this and, you know, principal that. And it's like really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know, again, if it's personal bias or if that's actually a thing. And some of them could be very smart. So, you know, good for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for them. But do you think like to become senior, like it has to do with the amount of time that you have worked or the amount of experience that you have gained while working? So for example, like we said, you mentioned earlier, like some people have different attitudes to this job. Mm-hmm. Some people, it's just a job. You go, you do your 9 to 5, you go home. Some people, they want to put extra effort to actually do more mm-hmm. and learn more. So like, if you compare these two sets of people, you realize like they are not consuming information at the same level. So I'm not sure. So that's what I'm asking mm-hmm. you actually. Do you think like it is a question of how long you have worked or a question of how much experience mm-hmm. you've gained while working to deserve this position?
I think it's probably the latter, because I would not consider myself like to have mastery in some specific, maybe to some extent, not to a crazy extent. I definitely know people who know way more about the subject than I do, but I know quite a bit. So, you know, I'm not the one for bragging, but, you know, doing JavaScript for so long and seeing how ecosystem has changed, you know, you learn a lot of quirks and things about it. So that would be probably like my strongest suit. But at the same time, I ended up knowing a little bit about a lot. And that allows you to just draw inferences across the board. So when you're analyzing some particular solution for something, these things just pop up and you consider them and they affect how you make decisions about things. And even though I'm not an expert, a lot of times what would happen is something would come into my head on some related subject and I would bring it up and I would be like, I'm not an expert in this, but have we considered thing A? And then somebody who might be an expert on thing A would be like, oh, okay, yeah, we didn't really have a chance to think about it. So it does help, because I don't know. Before I was saying that when estimating, if you start overanalyzing things, it actually makes things worse. And now I'm saying it's like, hey, I'm throwing all these different variables into the mix to make things better. So these two things seem to kind of contradict. But I think solutioning and like coming up with a solution is different from estimating how long that solution is going to take. So maybe I'm not entirely wrong. But yeah, you have to be flexible and you have to have a lot of knowledge across the board, because again, these things, like a website is a website is a website, but at the same time, it touches so many different things and it depends on so many different layers that make it all possible. You kind of have to consider all of them. And in order to consider all of them properly, you have to have some degree of experience in all of them, right? I remember back in the day when I was teaching at a boot camp, as an exercise, I would sort of posit this question to people. It's like you open up your browser and go to google.com and a page shows up on screen. Can you tell me about all of the things that had to happen for it to, you know, to happen? And you just start enumerating all of these different things and the list starts growing really, really fast, mm-hmm. right? And so, or I think originally the question was how many protocols are involved in making it happen? And you start thinking about it and there's a lot. And besides just the protocols and like the networking, there's all these other things that also need to happen. And so, you know, yeah, you don't necessarily have to consider all of them. Some of them might have no bearing on it whatsoever, but you know, it's better to have more avenues for exploration when thinking about these things. And I think the other thing with experience too, your brain tends to synthesize various things in a background. Like I don't have to specifically think about each kind of layer in that pie. It's more of something percolates from there and comes up and it's like, oh, we have to consider this more specific mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, definitely having a breadth of experience is a good thing in this case.
That's what I was thinking as well, because I know, like, again, I reference to social media, like sometimes you see some people have conversations about like, you can work in a company for like 2 years and then you get promoted to senior. And then some people will be like, well, you cannot know what a senior should know within 2 years. But then again, in my own opinion, I think it depends on different factors. I don't think timing is the only factor that that is exactly considered in this day.
I think just time is not sufficient to make that determination. And I think we talked about it before in one of our conversations. And I think at the time I said that, like, there, you know, you start calling yourself a senior and then you realize you're not exactly there yet. And after additional time, you kind of become comfortable with the idea that you may be calling yourself a senior and it's deserved. And I think that there's like a little bit of like Dunning-Kruger. It's like you don't necessarily know how ignorant you are because you're that ignorant at some point. And as you overcome that ignorance, you start learning all of these additional things. And then you realize like, oh, man, I now know that I do not know so much. And then you kind of cross that and arrive at the point where, okay, now I know enough to actually call myself that. And, you know, it's actually true. So, yeah, if people start boasting that they're a senior after a year or two in the industry, I usually tend to dismiss it, like, for most part, as it's a generalization. And it's possible that some of them are very dedicated and very interested, and they spend a lot of time learning their craft, and they've achieved this designation. Or maybe they don't know what they're talking about, and, you know, once we see the code, it will all be clear.
Exactly. But exactly. Like, once we see the codes, it will be clear. However, like, sometimes, like, you can also be very smart. But do you think, like, so the question is, so right now, like, some people are actually dedicated. You spend a lot of time. You try to, like, learn a lot of things. And you put in the work. But could it be a problem if, like, you put in the work in so many things? Let's say today you're learning JavaScript. Tomorrow you're learning Python. Or next week, or it's, what's that language now? Whatever language that comes up next week.
Right.
And you put in all, I know, like, when it comes to, so far in my own experience, I know, like, when it comes to, like, software or web development, it's specific, I feel like all of these things kind of relate to each other. So, like, this, maybe if you learn something in JavaScript or in Python, you can transfer the knowledge to Ruby or all these other languages that have, like, similar levels. And but necessarily, if you spread your efforts so much around like that, do you think it counts towards, like, experience, or do you think it's better to just, like, concentrate your effort on a certain part and just stick to it? And just stick to, let's say you develop, you write, like, Ruby codes, you just, like, stay there and write Ruby codes all your life and just stick to it.
I see.
Or, like, JavaScript and just stick to it.
I think we're talking about two different timelines, because I think that sticking to something for your entire life depends on your goals too. And, you know, for instance, there's, like, some people who play, like, that guy is, like, one of the 10 people on the planet who can play this very, very old and obscure instrument that is not really used by anyone. And he perfected it and achieved total mastery. And there's not many people like him around. And he can be very proud in that fact. You can go that route. You can be completely, like, sort of from that perspective. Or you can say, okay, what's the market situation right now? What is a reasonable set of languages that I can learn to be, you know, viably employed? There's this route. And I wouldn't say that. So in my personal experience, I don't remember doing that in a sense, like, trying, maybe the surface area was much smaller back then, I would say, because on compiled side, you had, like, C and C++ and maybe, like, Delphi. And on dynamic side, you had a little bit of Perl, a little bit of Python, a little bit of JavaScript, PHP. Like there wasn't really many languages that you could pick from, so you didn't really have to spread that thin. And there was no frameworks. Like the coolest thing at the time for PHP was the Smarty templating language, where you literally like write your templates and inject a bunch of PHP inside of them to render pages. And that was a pretty cool thing. So the amount of stuff you had to learn back in those days was definitely smaller. And you ended up doing a lot more yourself. Like other conversation I had recently was about how like there's not that much bespoke development that's happening. A lot of it is just gluing other people's libraries together. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you write business logic, but like business logic still. But in terms of like having something built completely from scratch, that barely ever happens. And obviously there's pressures, you know, you need to be quick to market. You don't want to introduce bugs and mistakes. So you sort of outsource the verification to all of the other users of a particular framework and hope that, you know, they're hitting all of the edge cases and ironing them out before you do. So you don't have to worry about it. Like I understand the reasons behind it. And so now, like with the internet and the open source and democratization of it all, there's just been like a complexity explosion in terms of all of the different things you can learn. So I wouldn't necessarily know how to answer this question because I never really had to encounter it at that stage. Like when I started, I was doing PHP because it was a happenstance. I happened to find a website by mistyping a URL. A little throwback moment. So when I was a kid, I liked playing the game Unreal Tournament, and there was a very popular site. It was actually multiple sites. It was like planetquake.com and planetunreal.com, and you would go to these websites to like download mods and like all this other stuff, and like just they had forums about the game. And one day, just on autopilot, instead of typing planetunreal.com for the American website, I typed in planetunreal.ru for the Russian website. And it opened up, and it was like a Russian forum of gamers who liked Unreal Tournament. And one of the things that they had on their website, they said, if you have a clan, you know, fancy term, if you have a clan, a gaming clan that plays Unreal Tournament, we can give you a web page with PHP and MySQL database for free. So just write to our email, admin. And I'm like, I don't have a clan, but who says I don't? And so I wrote to the guy and he gave me a little web page and it had PHP and it had MySQL and you would FTP into it and copy files over and build your website. So it's like, well, I guess I'm learning PHP now. So it wasn't a deliberate choice. It just happened that way. That's what I'm saying about luck, right? I just luckily ended up there. And, you know, you can write PHP and run it and it shows up on a page. And so I started learning PHP and I started learning MySQL. And it was completely terrible because I didn't know anything about relational databases. I didn't know anything about joins. So I would write a query with like four levels of subselects. And it did what I needed it to do. It just wasn't particularly optimal because I lacked the theory on it. And that's kind of how I started with web development, essentially, is just through that random website that I mistyped one day. And then later on, because I knew PHP, when I started working professionally, first iterations of the software we were writing was in PHP. And, you know, we were happily building it in PHP, and then we switched to ASP.NET web forms. And I started writing web forms as if I was writing PHP because, like, hey, it's a computer language, the requests come in. And then, you know, my boss at the time, he looked over my shoulder, he's like, oh, no, that's not how you do it, because in .NET, there's all these abstractions on top of it to make life easier for you. And my mind was like, whoa. I don't have to do all those things manually anymore. So we started writing in .NET, and I learned .NET forms, and I learned a bunch of obscure stuff about .NET forms and view states and things like that, and like optimizing them for reducing the payload sizes and things like that. And then we switched to MVC. And at the same time, like we were definitely building stuff with JavaScript. It was the time of prototype JS and Scriptaculous JS and like all of these libraries. It was the era of Web 2.0, where everybody was doing spinning barber poles and reflective surfaces and rounded corners. Every website had to have rounded corners. And when Shadows came on the stage, it was just like, oh my God, Shadows, Shadows that the browser renders for you. You don't have to have a transparent PNG full of shadows. And then Node came out and it's like, oh, look, there's this asynchronous thing and I can do all this crazy stuff. And it was just absolute callback soup. And it was pretty difficult to write back then. It was before NPM. And so I got into Node. So like these things kind of like fell from one to another. It's not like I was making deliberate choices to study this technology versus that. It's just like this thing presents itself and it looks interesting and you go for it. And it, the only advantage I have is just the 20 years that I've been doing it. Like if you give anybody 20 years to do it, they're going to learn a lot or not. But I hope they do because it's a lot of fun at the end of the day.
Yeah, I understand. Like over 20 years, of course, you must have had like different reasons to learn different things and different technologies. But what I was really checking was like, say, for example, let's say someone who just recently graduated from from school or from finished the program somewhere and is looking to learn a language that takes that gets them to work, you know? And then because I think in some programs in some schools, they get to learn different languages. For example, you can learn some things about Java, they teach you about Python, they teach you about C, C++, depending on the school.
Yeah.
So like you don't really pick one until you actually get out and you probably the first language you end up picking will be the language that you work with the your first job probably. And say for example, some people before that first job, they get overwhelmed with all these like buzzes around like, oh, Python is better than JavaScript, Rust is that, that, you know, they do all these comparisons and like they get all like, oh, tonight you're going to write Python, tomorrow you're going to write this. I mean, if I, my opinion is that it's not the worst thing ever because no experience is literally wasted. But I'm not sure if it's like the best thing to do when it comes to like building a niche for yourself, like engaging your own self, empowering your own self, like when it comes to like programming. I feel even though you will be able to learn different things happening across all these languages, across all these like different things, depending on how much effort you actually put into learning them, it might be more beneficial, say like in your first 2-3 years of in the industry to stick to one language and give yourself enough time to learn the ins and outs of it before jumping around to other languages.
I think that's fair. That's fair. I was when you were saying all of these things, I had this thought in my head about like if you stick with Pareto principle of saying like 80% of the result is achievable by 20% of the effort, and then the remaining 20% of the result is achievable with the 80% of the effort. So if you switch too often and you don't even get to the 20% of effort, then you're definitely losing out. Because it's definitely worthwhile to stick to something to get it to a decent level, because with these things, I think there's always ways to improve and optimize. And you also have to remember that you kind of go through these phases of trying to maybe, or not trying to, but like, I remember like, if I look at the code from 10, 15 years ago, it'll likely be more complicated than it should have been because I was still dreaming of some universal architecture that would support all of our needs. But that's kind of, now looking back at it, it's kind of silly because, you know, like a pure language within itself is able to support all of your needs. You just need to write it all bespoke. So if you try to put abstraction on it to help you do that, now you're working with something slightly inferior than the language purely by itself that has the constraints on you that you didn't think about. It can help you in a lot of ways, but you can reach a point where it's actually going to be detrimental. And you kind of have to go through that phase of over-engineering the hell out of everything to realize, like, oh, there's actually simpler ways of doing things, and I don't really have to do that this way. But in order to reach that point, you have to be proficient enough with the language where you can see that all of the, you know, all of the things that you've been building up until now, they could be cool and they could look interesting. But a lot of times, if you come back to them 6 months later and look back, you'd be like, oh, who wrote that? I don't understand anything that's happening in here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I kind of had two different thoughts mixed together, but definitely stick with the language for a while to get very comfortable with it. But at the same time, you can learn other things because they will affect how you think about your language. Like when I went to a bunch of Haskell meetups, even though I don't write any Haskell, they have affected the way that I view how I write my code in JavaScript, for instance. There was definitely this, oh, you know, even though I don't necessarily have to throw around terms like monads and functors and stuff from the Haskell land, I can definitely see some things where I can do similar things in JavaScript. But yeah, I also had the phase where I went through like the functional programming and it was like trying to over-optimize everything to be like as functional as possible. And now looking back, it was really interesting in the process. You feel like you have special powers, but like looking back at it, most of that code now is very, very difficult to reason about, and especially very difficult to debug. So in the it's kind of similar when we were talking about like the senior versus not really senior. You're at a point where it's like, oh, I'm so clever, look at this thing. Yeah. And then as you learn more, it's like, well, you don't really have to be that clever. You can be more elegant, right? So it's a transformation that everybody needs to go through for their professional growth.
Yeah. I agree with you. Thank you, Vasily. Thank you again for sharing your experiences. It's always a good time learning from you. I feel like there's a difference between when you actually spend all these years working and some people, you know, probably don't feel as comfortable sharing knowledge. But honestly, like, it's always like,
yeah,
a joy.
No, thank you for
to learn from you.
Thank you for interesting question. And I think the big caveat is, you know, it's all my personal opinion, and I could definitely be wrong about a lot of these things. A lot of them are sort of like a gut feeling or something that's crystallized over the years. And I would say that it is in some ways being colored by a certain degree of cynicism about this industry because, you know, we haven't really talked about it, but like the amount of crap in this industry is also overwhelming. And you kind of have to balance that out. So maybe it's something we can leave for our next discussion.
Really? Yeah. Sure. We can have it. We can have the conversation about it. Because, I mean, it happens, right?
Yeah. So, like, It does.
At some point.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your questions and for your time. And we'll chat soon.
All right. Talk soon.